I would suggest that the Jewish wedding ceremony actually tells us a great deal about what is unique about Jewish social and political thought, and that I believe that it is a matter of great interest that a Jewish wedding was witnessed by Rush, a signer of the Declaration. Because in comprehending all that is unique about a chuppah, we can also understand much that is unique about America and the Jewish mission in it.
The Tikva Fund presents Jewish Ideas and the American Founders. Jewish Ideas and the American Founders is dedicated by Alan K. Schwartz in memory of his wife, Barbara R. Schwartz, and in tribute to all Jewish Americans, both strangers and neighbors, and is supported by the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Soloveitchik, as we now turn to the next lecture, we're going to rejoin Jonas Phillips and his family in the story of how they embody certain aspects of American ideas. We're going to go to a wedding. Tell us about it.
This is a wedding that we know about from one of the most remarkable pieces of writing, certainly in American Jewish history, but maybe in American history. This is a letter being written by Benjamin Rush to his wife Julia, describing every detail of this Jewish wedding that he is attending. This is a wedding between Jonas Phillips' daughter and a young Jewish man from Virginia by the name of Levi, thereby uniting these two names together, Phillips and Levi. And Benjamin Rush is an incredibly open-minded and curious person. And so he will describe everything he sees, even though he often has no idea what's going on, such as hilariously during the prayer service that takes place beforehand. But he's also not ashamed to ask questions. So he will ask, what's with the canopy? Why do you guys break a glass? What's happening here? And what he doesn't realize he's doing, because he thinks he's just describing something that happened in the exact same way among Jews for hundreds of years and even thousands of years, is recording both the traditional Jewish ceremony, but also one that in its own way is unique. It's unique for several reasons. First, the chuppah, which we take as something which existed at Jewish weddings for thousands of years, is actually relatively new at this point in its universal status and use in Jewish weddings. Chuppah, originally in the Talmud, meant the home that the groom would build for his wife, not a canopy on a couple poles. So he's seeing the chuppah. He thinks it's something the Jews have done forever. And he asked Jews about it, and you can tell from their answer that they don't really know why that's happening either. So that's interesting in its own right. Another fascinating feature of this letter is that instead of just being a bunch of traditions performed by rote, it's actually a very interesting mixture of diverse Jewish traditions. Because we have to consider the following fact. Jonas Phillips was an Ashkenazi Jew. He married a Sephardic woman. He took on the Sephardic rite in public in the synagogues that he attended, and then he led Sheir with Israel in New York, Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia. The young man who's marrying his daughter is also, as far as we know, an Ashkenazi. Whereas the man performing the ceremony is the Sephardic leader of the synagogue in Philadelphia. So all sorts of different traditions are coming together. The law is the same. The liturgy is the same. But the traditions are going to be somewhat different. What you have is a whole new American Judaism. Ashkenazim and Sephardim living together, marrying each other. In a way, and mixing together in a way that would not have happened elsewhere in the world because they were their own communities living in their own places. There's a lot of very interesting things that's interesting to Rush and to us, and there are a lot of very interesting things that Rush doesn't even know are interesting, but are actually of intense interest to us looking back at this early American Jewish community. Having discussed the impact of political Hebraism on the formation of America, we turn back now to the saga of Jonas Phillips. As we mentioned in our opening talk, Jonas married a woman from a distinguished Sephardic family, and together they had, I am not making this up, 21 children. Jonas Phillips was literally American Jewry's founding father. Today, we discuss the wedding of one of these children, Rachel Phillips. The wedding to which, as we mentioned, Benjamin Rush was invited. And this is really the only firsthand account that we have of an American Jewish wedding from that era, colonial revolutionary era. Benjamin Rush writes as follows. This is to his wife. "My dear Julia, being called a few days ago to attend in the family of Jonas Phillips," meaning he had gone over there to make a house call because he was a doctor. You have 21 kids, you're going to be calling the doctor a lot. "Being called a few days ago to attend in the family of Jonas Phillips, I was honored this morning with an invitation to attend the marriage of his daughter to a young man of the name of Levy from Virginia. I accepted the invitation with great pleasure, for you know I love to be in the way of adding to my stock of ideas upon all subjects. At 1 o'clock, the company, consisting of 30 or 40 men, assembled in Mr. Phillips' common parlor, which was accommodated with benches for the purpose. The ceremony began with prayers in the Hebrew language, which was chanted by an old rabbi, and in which he was followed by the whole company." This is what we mentioned in our opening talk, leading to the immortal line, "As I did not understand a word, except now and then an amen or hallelujah, my attention was directed to the haste with which they covered their heads with their hats as soon as the prayers began, and to the freedom with which some of them conversed with each other during the whole time of this part of their worship." That just stays funny every time. "As soon as these prayers were ended, which took up about 20 minutes, a small piece of parchment was produced, written in Hebrew, which contained a deed of settlement, and which the groom subscribed in the presence of 4 witnesses. In this deed, he conveyed a part of his fortune to his bride, by which she was provided for after his death in case she survived him. The ceremony was followed by the erection of a beautiful canopy composed of white and red silk in the middle of the floor. It was supported by 4 young men by means of 4 poles who put on white gloves for the purpose. As soon as this canopy was fixed, the bride, accompanied with her mother, sister, and a long train of female relations, came downstairs. Her face was covered with a veil, which reached halfway down her body. She was handsome at all times, but the occasion and her dress rendered her, in a peculiar manner, a most lovely and affecting object. I gazed with delight upon her. Innocence, modesty, fear, respect, and devotion appeared all at once in her countenance. She was led by her 2 bridesmaids under the canopy. 2 young men led the bridegroom after her and placed him not by her side, but directly opposite to her. The priest now began to chant a Hebrew prayer, in which he was followed by part of the company. After this, he gave to the groom and bride a glass full of wine, from which they each sipped about a teaspoonful. Another prayer followed this act, after which he took a ring and directed the groom to place it upon the finger of his bride in the same manner as is practiced in the marriage service of the Church of England. This ceremony was followed by handing the wine to the father of the bride and then a second time to the bride and groom. The groom, after sipping the wine, took the glass in his hand and threw it upon a large pewter dish which was suddenly placed at his feet. Upon its breaking into a number of small pieces, there was a general shout of joy and a declaration that the ceremony was over. The groom now saluted his bride, and kisses and congratulations became general throughout the room. Ad kan for us for now. We'll read up till this point. Now, commenting on Dr. Rush's letter, editor of commentary John Podhoretz wrote that not only is Rush's description simple, plain, and accurate then and now, it testifies to the wondrous imaginative sympathy that even these 18th century Americans had toward the Jewish people and offers a glimpse of the unparalleled freedom this nation would extend toward Jews. And that is absolutely true and will be a focus of ours in the talks that remain. But I would suggest that Rush's letter is even more significant than that. The truth is that due in part to Jewish powerlessness, there are very few texts composed over the centuries of the Jewish diaspora that relate directly to politics. There is, however, one foundationally Jewish social compact that has been performed again and again, and that is the halachic wedding. And it's this ceremony that I plan to analyze today and utilize it as a lens by which to speak about America. To put it slightly differently, I wish to bring the ritual of the chuppah, the way in which we Jews found a family, into conversation with the founding documents of this country. I would suggest that the Jewish wedding ceremony actually tells us a great deal about what is unique about Jewish social and political thought, and that I believe that it is a matter of great interest that a Jewish wedding was witnessed by Rush, a signer of the Declaration. Because in comprehending all that is unique about a chuppah, we can also understand much that is unique about America and the Jewish mission in it. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in a book of his on political thought, notes that there are two ways of speaking in modernity of the founding of a political society. Western political thinkers like Rousseau and Locke spoke of a social contract, whereas the Bible spoke most often about berit, covenant. Social contract describes an arrangement in which members of society give away aspects of their autonomy in order to gain something else for themselves. In a covenant, in contrast, the two parties come together to achieve what neither can achieve alone, a destiny. In the words of H. Richard Niebuhr, a covenant is the binding together in one body politic of persons who assume unlimited responsibility to and for each other under God. We find a social contract in the book of Samuel, where the people of Israel, as we referenced this morning, agreed to the increased power of a king over their lives in order to experience his protection. But the premier social compact in the Bible is covenant or brit. What is the difference between the two, contract and covenant? As Rabbi Sacks notes, contracts are entered into for mutual advantage. Covenant is about moral commitment. A contract is secular in nature. A covenant is faith-based. A contract is a transaction. A covenant is a relationship. In a contract, what matters is that both gain. In a covenant, what matters is that both give. In a contract, two individual eyes seek their own benefit. In a covenant, two eyes become a we. Rabbi Sacks adds that in the ideal conception of society, covenants do not displace contracts, they merely address different aspects of our lives. A society that is all contract, meaning society that is all about self-interest, is not really a society. But a society that is all unity is also not a society. It is a sect. And on a larger scale, it is totalitarianism. Throughout history, he writes, utopian thinkers have dreamt of a perfect world in which all individual striving is abolished, its place taken by harmony. That dream has led to some of the worst bloodshed in history. Utopias, he writes, have no room for difference, and difference is what makes us human. So, both concepts, contract and covenant, seeking assurance of fulfillment of self-interest and coming together in unity to become something larger than our respective selves. Both contract and covenant are vital. Now, Rabbi Sacks notes that the simplest form of a covenant is marriage, and that is certainly true. A Jewish marriage begins with what is today called kiddushin, the sanctification of the relationship, usually formed with the giving of a ring nowadays, but fully concludes with the nisuin ceremony, in which a man and a woman under the chuppah become husband and wife by creating a home together. For us now, nisu'in takes the form of reciting the Sheva Brachot, the seven blessings under the chuppah, which represents their home. But the liturgy of the blessings truly are covenantal. They reflect the fact that here two I's are becoming a we. But I would add that if we study the way that a Jewish wedding takes place, we find both conceptions here too, of contract and covenant. Let us ponder the document that Rush witnessed being signed, which he described as a Hebrew document subscribed by several witnesses. What document is this? That is the ketubah. Now, as a rabbi, I do weddings, and sometimes I'm honored with the reading of the ketubah, and I'm always struck by the way audiences, and indeed members of the wedding party, treat the ketubah as if it is a romantic, a mystical symbol of the marriage. So the beautiful calligraphy and the framing and hanging of the ketubah. Now, in part, people react to the ketubah in this way because actually when Benjamin Rush wrote that this was a document written in Hebrew, he was wrong. This document is not in Hebrew. The document is in Aramaic, which sounds so foreign to us today, almost like, you know, a spell from Harry Potter or something like that. Expecto Patronus. But it's in ancient Aramaic because that, not Hebrew, was once the vernacular. And it was meant to be understood because this is a contract to which the groom is obligating himself. What's being discussed is technical and mundane. It is affirming the husband's promise to support his wife and to obligate his estate to ensure her well-being in case something happens to the marriage. This is not understood. A recent New York Times article, a couple years ago, revealed a new trend in evangelical Christian weddings, ketubas. Quote, Sally and Mark Austin are part of a growing phenomenon of non-Jews incorporating the ketubah, a document with millennia-old origins and a rich artistic history, into their weddings. Mrs. Austin, in fact, first learned about the ketubah from her older sister, also an evangelical Christian. The ketubah, the Times tells us, represented to the Austins a broader concept of holiness, of consecration of their relationship. Quote, we wanted a permanent reminder of the covenant we made with God, said Mrs. Austin. And that is lovely, but a ketubah is not a covenant. It is a contract. It is not a berit. The Hebrew word for what it is a shtar. The Sheva Brachot, the seven blessings that follow, are covenantal, but the ketubah is not. It's not about consecration. Here are two words that do not appear in the ketubah. Love and God. Neither of these words appear in the ketubah. It ends with the remarkably unromantic words, V'hakol Sharir V'kayam. All is binding, which is, as any Jewish contract, transactional halachic document ends. The ketubah affirms a balance of interests. The groom wishes to get married, and the bride, in agreeing, seeks to ensure her own well-being. They both want something out of this. And yet, for all the unromantic, self-interested nature of the ketubah, the fact is we take great pains, as Rush saw, to ensure its completion in a formal ceremony before the nisu'in can proceed. Ashkenazim, developed beginning with Rabbeinu Tam, actually pause the ceremony to read the ketubah to the audience. This was not done here, as you may have noticed, which reflects the fact that they were following Portuguese Jewish ritual, which does not have, to this day, the reading of the ketubah in the ceremony. There are Sephardic Jews that do. In fact, you see this among Jews from Morocco, who have what is known as the ketubah of Castile, of Castilian Jewry, in which the ketubah is actually not read but sung. And I'll tell you a little more about that a little bit later. But they are following, for public ritual, the traditions of this community. So they're not reading the ketubah here, but they are signing it in great ceremony. And many Jews actually read this ketubah, which you think, therefore, should be some incredibly romantic document, but it is not. So then why do they focus so much on it? And the answer, I think, is that covenantal marriage must be joined with contract. If ketubah precedes nisuin, if contract precedes the covenantal blessings of the Sheva Brachot, the message is that without law, there can be no love. Without shtar, there could be no brit. Without contract, there could be no covenant. Without recognition of difference, of self-interest, there can be no relationship. My grandfather was once honored with the reading of a ketubah in Chicago, and he was in a wheelchair and was somewhat weak, and the ketubah was one of those massive framed affairs, you know, and so I was holding it for him as he read it. And most of the ketubah was smooth sailing. He was basically reading it by heart, but it was adorned with beautiful, easy-to-read calligraphy. But then he gets to the bottom where the witnesses had scrawled their names. And try as he might, he could not make out the name of the second witness's father. So he's reading something like, he says, Na'um, he's reading it on this microphone, there's like 500 people there. Na'um, Reuven Ben, and I'm holding the ketubah for him as he looks up at me, and I'm like, oh. So at that point, he just has the microphone, he goes, Na'um, Reuven Ben Ploni, and hands the microphone back, which means so-and-so in Hebrew. Now, the truth is, at the heart of the ketubah and its reading and its ceremony is the assumption that despite the romantic setting, these are individuals, different people. They are not just identityless, abstract plonies. These are two unique eyes, not one eye being subsumed into the other. The husband is not being subsumed into the wife's identity and vice versa. They are unique people. Their names are spelled out. Reuven ben Shimon, Chasandana, and Leah bas Levi, Besultada. Only after that does the covenantal aspect of the wedding proceed. Then and only then do we recite the seven blessings forming the covenantal marriage under the chuppah. First, the ketubah is read. And at that point, by the way, they are only partially on their way to becoming husband and wife. A pet peeve of mine is after the ring is given and the rabbi says, you are now married, because they are not married. All that means is that the relationship has become bound and now the woman cannot marry anyone else. And then the ketubah is read. The ketubah is read not as sanctification, but as a statement or even a warning. These are individuals. Each one is an individual. Each one has something to gain. Each one is entitled to self to their respect. One is not being subsumed into the other. And they only become fully husband and wife in what follows after that, with the Sheva Brachot said under the chuppah. And when we recite these blessings, when the Nisuin takes place, then the language that is pronounced is remarkable, romantic, glorious, covenantal. The couple for the blessings being recited are not just two parties contracting. They are Re'im HaHuvim, which means beloved covenantal partners. They are establishing, as they say, a binyan adeyad, a source of immortality. They are linked in history. They are a link in history. Beginning in Eden, so we say in the blessing, may God make you rejoice, kisamecha chayitzircha began Eden mikedem, as your creator caused Adam and Eve to rejoice in Eden of old, and ending ultimately in redemption. As we say, sos tasis v'tagel ha'akara, may the barren one, meaning Jerusalem, ultimately rejoice. And this marriage, whatever Jewish marriage is taking place, that marriage is seen as inspiring the ultimate covenantal emotion, which is hope, faith in the future. Od yishama bi'arei Yehuda uv'chutzot Yerushalayim, kol sason, kol simcha, kol chatan, v'kol kala. Will once again be heard in the hills of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem. Sounds of rejoicing, sound of bride and groom. And so ketubah is contract, nisuin is covenant. They are both essential but very different. And that is why the ketubah, the non-covenantal but vital declaration of separate interests, requires merely two witnesses in order to sign it. While the covenantal ceremony, the blessings of the nisuin, requires a minyan, the blessings of 10. Because the minyan, according to Jewish law, embodies the tzibur, the community, linking us to the Jewish people, past, present, and future, which means that you cannot get married in Judaism without a minyan. It is impossible to elope in Jewish law unless you bring 10 of your best friends with you to Aruba when you want to get married. And that's because, in a literal sense, marriage is not a private affair in Judaism. What you are doing impacts the Jewish people. It's not just about you. There need to be spectators in your marriage. Covenants in Judaism involve the entire Jewish people. And so inherent in this covenant is the notion that the union being created involves not only the two parties, but the future well-being of others. That's why elopement is impossible. That's why chuppah has to be a public event. The requirement of a minyan for the blessings of nisuin, for the sheva brachot, the blessings under the chuppah, indicates that what is occurring is covenant, and therefore impacts the entire nation of Israel. In his remarkable autobiography, Fear No Evil, Natan Sharansky describes his rushed July wedding. He was married, I believe, on July 4th to his wife in a Moscow apartment the day before she left for Israel. The rabbi they had found refused to let the ceremony go forward because they had only 9, not 10. And moreover, he told them that if they didn't find a 10 soon, it would be sundown, and that sundown would be Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, and then he couldn't get married. So Sharansky had to go stand out on the street in, you know, Cold War Russia, looking for a 10th Jew to help make a minyan so he could get married. And eventually a minyan was assembled, and they were married with a humble bedsheet serving as their chuppah. Sharansky's wife left for Israel the next day, and he promised her that he would join her soon. Her marriage to him was an extraordinary act of faith because she didn't know for sure that she would ever see him again. And of course, even though he promised that he would see her soon, they did not reunite until years later, with Sharansky famously telling his wife, "Slicha she'icharti k'tzat," sorry, I'm a little late. And to me, this story captures the fact that every Jewish wedding embodies covenantal faith in the Jewish people, and that a chuppah first performed in the midst of a seemingly hopeless evil empire can actually be a harbinger of a husband and wife ultimately rejoicing in the streets of Jerusalem. So, with the Jewish marriage in mind, let us turn to America. Rabbi Sacks, who is himself a member of the British House of Lords, wistfully remarks in his book that only America, alone among modern politics, actually combines contract with covenant. It has its own social contract, the Constitution of 1787, which sets out its form of government, and it has the equivalent of covenant, the Declaration of Independence of 1776. Now, this is an excellent point, and I think it requires real elaboration. The Constitution is a secular shtar. Its genius lies in recognizing that society is made up of a variety of factions that are each different, unique with its own motivations and interests, and in the Constitution's attempt to balance and preserve the rights of these factions. Very few people understand that that is what the essence of the Constitution is. Most people miss that today. Justice Scalia, of blessed memory, has noted that he often asks people, why do you think America is such a free country? What is it in the Constitution that makes us who we are? And the answer is always, First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, etc. Bill of Rights. But he notes that the truth is every banana republic has a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights of the Soviet Union, you can look it up, is a way more impressive Bill of Rights than that of the United States. Bill of Rights of the Soviet Union guarantees freedom of speech, of the press, street demonstrations and protests, and it states that anyone who is caught trying to suppress criticism of the government will be called to account. That's in the Soviet Bill of Rights. So the point is that that Bill of Rights is just what the founders called a parchment promise. It means nothing unless you have a governmental structure that will allow these rights to be enforced and guarantees that these rights will not be trampled. Or to put it differently, what's essential to freedom is a political structure in which no individual or political faction can dominate the government, which could lead to tyranny. And that's what makes the Constitution unique, not the Bill of Rights. Soviet Union also has an amazing Bill of Rights. Anyone caught suppressing criticism of the government will be held to account. Of course, it's meaningless. So, Bill of Rights are meaningless unless you have a structure that prevents tyranny. And that's what makes the Constitution unique. As much as the founders may have desired democracy, they were equally concerned, if not more so, of the democratic tyranny of the majority. The separation of powers is not merely setting in place a democratic republic. It is built to guarantee the rights of minorities. I don't just mean ethnic minorities. I mean minorities of groups of different self-interested people, economic minorities, economic factions, religious factions. As Scalia notes, if a bill is about to pass that really comes down hard on some minority, and they think it's terribly unfair, it doesn't take much to throw a monkey wrench into this complex system, because we have a system unlike any other, with a true bicameral legislature, two independent houses, independent executive, and for any law to pass, you have to get them to agree. And then that has to be approved by an independent judiciary. No other country has a system like this. People misunderstand the American system. They kvetch, they krecht, and they moan about gridlock. They say our greatest problem is gridlock. As George Will once put it, gridlock is not an American problem. Government gridlock is an American solution, because the founders didn't want a parliament where a bare majority of representation could pass sweeping social change. When the founding fathers went to Philadelphia in 1787, as Will notes, they did not gather in order to found a merely efficient government. That idea would have horrified them. They wanted a safe government, to which end they created a government full of blocking mechanisms. Three branches of government, two branches of the legislature, veto, override, judicial review, and yet one can think of nothing that the American people have wanted intensely and protractedly that they did not eventually get. So what that means is that to truly pass anything in this country, you need to convince a wide variety of factions of different people in society. And the founders were fine with that, because as they believed, as Winston Churchill said, that the American people will invariably do the right thing after they have exhausted all of the alternatives. American politics is a mess, and it is very hard to pass anything. It's certainly very hard to pass sweeping social change. Of course, five unelected judges can just decree that, but that's a different problem to be discussed at another time. But legislatures cannot pass sweeping social change. It's very hard and very long, and you have to convince a great deal of different factions in America. American politics is no utopia, and thank God, because utopias, as we quoted, have no room for difference, and difference is what makes us human. The Constitution, the Shtar, the contract of America, like the Ketubah, embodies the recognition and preservation of diverse human interests and thereby of the fact of human difference. That's the case Madison makes for the Constitution. He says human difference is inevitable. And difference of opinion, freedom is like oxygen, and human difference will just happen. It's a fact of life. And our goal is not to squash that, but actually to create a government in which people can come together to make majority rule, but also protect the minority from the majority. Preservation of diverse human interests, human difference lies at the heart of the Constitution. And if Americans, despite their differences, are still able to come together, it is because of America's other great founding document, which is very different from the Constitution. The Declaration of Independence is a covenantal document, bringing about, as Niebuhr described, the binding together of persons who assume responsibility to and for each other under God. The document declares a great idea, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. To perpetuate this idea, individuals are bound together not in self-interest, but in covenant under God. And thus the conclusion, and for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And with this declaration came the founders' covenantal recognition that what they were choosing to do affected not only them, but their posterity and the world. Thus, John Adams' statement, quote, "I always consider the settlement of America with reverence as the opening of a grand design in Providence for the illumination and emancipation of the slavish part of mankind all over the earth." So it's fitting then that the religious nature of the gatherings that produced these distinct documents, the Constitution and the Declaration, Contract and Covenant, were very different from one another. During the debate over the construction of the Constitution, with the delegates deadlocked, Benjamin Franklin, age 80, rose to suggest that perhaps prayer was appropriate. And he said, "How has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly appealing to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understandings? God governs in the affairs of men, and if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid?" That's Franklin. The delegates immediately ignored his request. And the document produced is profoundly secular in nature. The word God, like in the Ketubah, does not appear in the Constitution. But in 1774, as delegates gathered in the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, the Congress that would ultimately lead the revolution and produce the Declaration, it was proposed that they begin with prayer so that the delegates may gain in sobriety and wisdom. This was objected to by John Jay, later the first Supreme Court Chief Justice. And John Jay argued that they could not join together in prayer as they were so divided religiously among Episcopalians, Quakers, Anabaptists, Presbyterians, and Congregationalists. Now, to us, given the future religious diversity of America, these theological divisions among Protestants seem minuscule. I was reminded when I was once taking courses at Yale Divinity School and at student orientation, so we're sitting out on the lawn, and before I spoke, I have like these circles of students, and some student from one of the Dakotas says something like, "You know, I really feel like I'm sticking out here, being a Presbyterian among so many Episcopalians." Meanwhile, the guy with the yarmulke, me, was thinking, "Yeah, I hate when that happens." When you're Episcopal, when you're Presbyterian, everyone's Episcopal. That's the worst. But in Europe, people, you know, had been killing each other, not that, you know, pretty recently over these Protestant divisions. And so Jay's argument that the prayer cannot take place could be understood. At that moment, Samuel Adams stood up and said that he was no bigot and that he would hear a prayer from any gentleman of piety and virtue, which was also a friend to his country. They went out to find a clergyman. They brought in a Episcopal, then called Anglican priest by the name of Duché. Interestingly, side note, he eventually became a loyalist. You can look that up. But he came in and he read Psalm 35, Tehillim Lamed Hei. "Plead my cause, O Lord, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation." John Adams wrote to his wife that evening, "I never saw a greater effect on an audience. Who can realize the emotions with which they turned imploringly to heaven for divine imposition and aid?" He says, "I must beg of you to read that psalm." Commenting on this story and others, the Catholic theologian Michael Novak noted that because of the denominational divisions, which were clearly a concern for some of them, the founders sought to avoid theologically loaded Christian verses. And what happened was that the language of the Hebrew Bible became the central language of the American metaphysic. The background to the American vision of history and the destiny of humanity. In other words, it is the sense of a providential covenantal mission that allows us to overcome differences, to bind very different individuals in a common destiny. In support of this declaration, with a mutual reliance on divine providence, we pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. This is the role that Hebraic thinking and covenantal description played in the founding of America, because it is the nation of Israel's concept of covenant, of integration without assimilation, that so inspired the founders. For in pondering how such a diverse series of states from Maine to Carolina could become one nation indivisible, the answer they came up with was covenants. Or to put it slightly differently, when the founders were pondering how a marriage of states and of diverse societies could take place, creating the largest republic in the history of man, how a country could come together without in any way undoing the differences between them, the political language that they used was covenant. As the political philosopher Daniel Elazar wrote, covenantal thinking was the common mode of political conceptualization and expression during the American Revolution. And the founders, of course, knew that in the Hebrew Bible it is covenant through which 12, or counting Ephraim and Manasseh separately, 13 diverse tribes become one. And from the Hebrew Bible, they took the concept of covenant, a coming together for an ordained destiny, a society that would be built out of difference and yet embody covenantal unity. Read the sermons of the prominent clergymen of that era, some of whom we mentioned this morning. Here is another. Samuel Langdon, New England pastor, president of Harvard during the Revolution. Quote, "The God of heaven hath not visibly displayed his majesty and power before our eyes as he came down in the sight of Israel on the mount. But the interpositions of divine providence fall little short of real miracles and a heavenly charter of liberty for these United States. We cannot but acknowledge," he said, "that God hath graciously patronized our cause and taken us under his care, as he did his ancient covenant people." End quote. There is, of course, only one chosen nation. But Lincoln called America an almost chosen nation. And what that means is, first, that America has a providential role to play in history, but also that it is inspired by God's ancient covenant people. Built into the phrase is both an extraordinary praise, but also a warning. It is stating, in calling America an almost chosen people, that America is a nation unlike any other because it is inspired by the Hebraic story. But unlike biblical Israel, who is actually chosen and can therefore mess up as much as it does and still be chosen and still be eternal, America is almost chosen, meaning its chosenness, its exceptional nature, remains as long as it is connected to its covenantal calling and its principles. Losing that, and it ceases to be in any way exceptional. Lincoln uses this phrase because he believed, as I do, that America has a providential role to play in history, and that it was inspired by America's concept of covenant. It is therefore remarkable that a signer of America's declaration, signer of America's covenant, in the home of Jonas Phillips, witnessed a chuppah, a covenant, a marriage through which diverse persons became one. Because it is the Jewish concept of covenant and of diverse people becoming one without doing away entirely with their differences that so inspired the founding fathers. After the ceremony, Benjamin Rush reports that he went to go say goodbye to the mother of the bride, Rebecca Machado Phillips, mother of 21 children. By the way, she wasn't yet done with having kids at this point of the wedding, because Benjamin Rush later wrote to describe that a year or two later he was invited to the circumcision of another baby born to Jonas Phillips, sometime after the wedding of one of his older daughters already occurred. So Dr. Rush writes that he went to the kitchen to say goodbye to the mother of the bride, and he, quote, "discovered the bride and groom supping a bowl of broth together." And he writes to his wife, Julia, that Mrs. Phillips, meaning that's the mother of the bride, apologized for them, for the bride and groom, by telling me that they had eaten nothing since the night before, agreeably to the custom prescribed by their religion. This is interesting in its own right, because the tradition of fasting on a wedding day is an entirely Ashkenazic Jewish tradition. And though Jonas Phillips married into a distinguished Sephardic family, he was himself Ashkenazi, as was the groom who was marrying his daughter. So you have this very interesting situation in which publicly what's taking place is a Sephardic ceremony, because that is the liturgy and traditions of the elite, and therefore that is the traditions that everyone follows in the public sphere. And yet, in their own life, they're observing the traditions they received from their forefathers. So the chatan is an Ashkenazi. He's not going to wear a kittel when he's getting married. Had he put on a kittel, that would have been noticed by Benjamin Rush, and he would have put that in the letter. He's not going to do a kittel because he can't be like one of those lowly Ashkenazim when you're out in the public. There you got to do what the Sephardim are doing. But you're still keeping Ashkenazic Jewish tradition. And this is a melding of traditions in a way unlike anywhere else on earth at this time. Because by and large, Ashkenazim and Sephardim lived separately. By and large, they lived in separate regions of the world, with the possible exception of Amsterdam and a few other places where they by and large kept apart from one another. So in America, you see being born here, in its own way, a uniquely American observant Judaism, that in which even as Sephardic liturgy rules, all sorts of Ashkenazic traditions will begin to impact and seep in. So that if you go to my synagogue today, you will see that they stand for Kaddish, even though Sephardim don't stand for Kaddish. It's like, unfortunately, the best Sephardic tradition, the not having to get constantly stand up all the time, is the one tradition that we don't have. Or you'll see on Chanukah that every single song sung is sung to the tune of Mo's Tzur, though they do not sing Mo's Tzur. That's a song for Ashkenazim. So you have been created here in its own way, an interesting community that is impact, in which the diversity of Jews from all over the world that are arriving in America are impacting each other. Then, after finding the bride and groom breaking their fast on a bowl of broth, Rush then confirms that all Jewish homes were the same at all times by telling his wife Julia in his letter that, quote, "Upon taking my leave, Mrs. Phillips put a large piece of cake into my pocket for you, which she begged I would present to you with her best compliments." You can't leave a Jewish home without having cake. And the story of the Phillips family and of Rush's letter is so mesmerizing, precisely because there is this mix of aspects of Judaism and of Jewish life that seem never to change, that are eternal. And therefore, when you put that together with these incredible moments, a founding father attending a Jewish wedding in a home in Philadelphia in 1787, it actually makes those moments stand out even more prominently. Benjamin Rush then concludes by reflecting that during the whole of this new and curious scene, my mind was not idle. He writes, "I was carried back to the ancient world and was led to contemplate the Passovers, the sacrifices, the jubilees of Judaism." In other words, Rush is exemplifying here the fascination that many of America's founders had with the Jewish people and the story of Israel. Of course, as he himself knows at the end of the letter, he's a Christian. He's a very religious Christian. He looks forward to the end time when Jews themselves would embrace the Savior that he has embraced, and they would become Christians too. But someone who believes that devoutly and yet is able to be part of this ceremony with joy and with love and with warmth and with interest is something that could not take place anywhere else on earth. And seeing the wedding through his eyes, we who usually sit at a chuppah as if we're seeing nothing extraordinary and just schmoozing amongst ourselves, talking, chatting to each other, as Rush noted, schmoozing just as, unfortunately, we may talk during Chazaras HaShatz, talking entirely through the chuppah, we may not actually pause to ponder what Rush himself understood and was so impacted by. What a miracle the continuity of the Jewish covenant actually is. To attend a wedding in Israel today, where the prophet's prediction of Od Yishama B'Yarei Yehuda V'Chutzot Yerushalayim Kol Sason V'Kol Simcha Kol Chatan V'Kol Kala has been fulfilled, is to see a miracle with your own eyes. And all anyone is doing in the courtyard of a hotel, or even at times on a mountaintop overlooking Har Habayit, is standing and schmoozing with one another as if it's the most commonplace thing in the world. But the founders understood that covenant binds generations. And if it is the Hebraic covenant, that binds generations to a mysterious and eternal people, then there is what to learn from and be inspired by those people. And it is the wedding where a family is founded and another link in a covenant is created, where we are meant to remark upon that most of all. Rush understood this. We miss this. We need to see it through his eyes to understand this. I was once asked to attend a wedding of the son of one of the lay leaders of Madrid. So the wedding took place in Miami. And at this wedding, the Castilian ketubah, the special ketubah that has been used by the Jews that were exiled from Castile and went to Morocco and Gibraltar, I was asked to sing that ketubah under the chuppah. They gave me a recording. I spent the next month and a half listening to this ketubah over and over. It has its own interesting additions to the text. And then stood there at this wedding of this Spanish Jew, and I sang it. And FYI, I nailed it. But the ketubah ends as follows. V'hakol kefi haminhag v'atnai shenagu v'shiitkinu kilot ha-kodesh ha-migurashot mi-kastia. And all has been done according to the laws and the traditions and the rituals of the holy communities of Jews that were exiled from Castile. Hashem yishmor nishmatam. May God guard their souls. V'yachon v'yarachem al sheirit pleitatam. And have mercy on the remnants of their exiles. And I was standing there reading this, and I'm thinking that I myself have visited Madrid, and I've seen statues of Ferdinand and Isabella, and that family is gone. Ferdinand and Isabella are gone. And the people they exiled are still singing this ketubah, still forming marriages, still building another link in the Jewish people. This is a miracle. And the fact that Benjamin Rush reacts to it not with horror, as many religious Christians who denied the existence of a truly living and blessed Judaism might have done, the fact that Rush reacts to it with wonder is something that is meant to inspire us and is meant to instruct us about the role that the Hebraic imagination played for the founders. But in truth, Jewish marriages played a miraculous role, not only in the Jewish people, as it always does, but in the story of America itself. For as we know, the child born to this couple was a man by the name of Uriah Phillips Levy, who would go on, as we will discuss soon, to, after a distinguished naval career, to buy the rundown home of Thomas Jefferson, restore it, save it from ruin. Benjamin Rush was struck with wonder at the wedding that he was seeing and had no idea that he was attending the wedding of a couple whose child would be amazingly formative in preserving the legacy of one of his best friends who had just authored a declaration that he had just signed. He knows he's witnessing something extraordinary, but he himself does not know how extraordinary the wedding he is actually experiencing, actually is. There's a story from the annals of my community, which took place during the Revolutionary War. And that is at a time when most of New York's Jews had fled to Philadelphia. And several Jews, some Jews had stayed, those were the Tories, the Tory Jews. And there was a Jew left in New York by the name of Samuel Lazarus. And he was getting married in New York. But there was no clergy in New York because Gershom Mendes Sachs, spiritual leader of Sheretz Israel, patriot rabbi of the revolution, had fled. So sends a message to Reverend Sachs. And Sachs, covering himself up, after all, he's someone who's openly supported the revolutionary cause, under much danger to himself, sneaks into Manhattan and performs the ceremony for a Jew that supported the other side, forming a new link in the Lazarus family. And the great-granddaughter or granddaughter of that couple was Emma Lazarus, whose poem ultimately embodied the very essence of the wonder that is America, which is good as indication as any that a Jewish marriage is not only, though it is first and foremost, a link in the miraculous chain that is the Jewish people. It is also creating a next step in a covenantal continuity that may produce miracles that we can scarcely imagine. That, if that is true about the Lazarus family, that is certainly all the more true about the Phillips family and the couple that Benjamin Rush witnesses right here. It was written, as I mentioned, to Thomas Jefferson himself, describing the revolution. A friend wrote to him, "Cannot it be said that there is an angel that rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm?" Meaning that God's hand, the design of providence, could be seen in the story of the birth of America. Whether Jefferson himself believed that or not, that I'm not so sure. But one of the surest signs of the miraculous nature of America's founding and of the hand of providence is the story of this family, witnessed by a signer of the Declaration of Independence. A family forms and gives birth to a child that will go on to save the home and preserve the legacy of the author of that declaration. And the bride, whom Benjamin Rush witnessed being married under that chuppah, to this day lies buried in Monticello, an enduring connection between the Hebraic story, the Jewish story in America, and the Declaration itself, which more than any other document in American history founds America as a truly covenantal nation. When one forms a Jewish marriage, one does not know what miracles may follow. Certainly, in the story of the Phillips family, the hand of providence in their family and in America can be seen. The story to us today remains an inspiring one. It teaches us at every Jewish wedding to ponder the miracle of Jewish covenantal continuity, but also to ponder how the Jewish concept of covenant impacted America and thereby changed the world, and to inspire us to pray that America may be blessed with other miracles yet to come. Thank you very much.
In this lecture, you showed us how the coming together of Jonas Phillips' daughter and her husband can shed some light on the coming together of this new nation.
At the heart of the Jewish philosophy of marriage is the following question. How do we create a ritual which emphasizes two separate ideas that seem to be in tension with one another, but actually complement one another? The first idea is that, of course, a marriage is a union. It is the coming together of two individuals so that together they can be something larger than their respective selves. At the same time, and here's the other idea, the coming together does not mean that husband or wife loses his or her individual identity. They don't stop being themselves. The wife is not submerged into the identity of the husband, and the husband is not submerged into the identity of the wife. And even as they're coming together in a union that is to a great extent about love and devotion and giving and generosity and living for someone other than yourself, there's also a great deal of self-interest at the heart of marriage. And Judaism stresses that to forget that sets up the marriage for disaster. Self-interest in terms of companionship, self-interest in terms of financial security, self-interest in terms of sexual needs, self-interest in a variety of different ways, which Judaism insists in its realism that we cannot ignore, and that the way to channel these desires is through marriage. So on the one hand, you have a union. On the other hand, the very ritual creating that union has to recognize individuality as well. So how do you have both? To some extent, that's similar to the question faced by the founders of the American Republic, because unlike other republics in history, which were largely city-states, like Venice, the question facing this vast republic is, how can we have unity but also diversity? How can we recognize individuality but still come together? And the case made against the Constitution was that this stronger centralized government would destroy the individuality of its citizens and of the states. So what is the genius of America for creating a republic that allows for both unity and diversity? And so the question they face is somewhat similar to the questions facing creators of a ritual around marriage. Of course, the rabbis create a ritual around marriage, and it develops and evolves over the centuries. But largely, they are all coming together to address this central question. And whether it's the blessings or the documents, such as the ketubah, or the object that ultimately embodies the home that the bride and groom are building together, the canopy, the chuppah, each addresses one of these aspects of marriage in its own way, so that in a complementary manner, you are creating a picture of a unity that allows also for individuality. And that, I argue, sheds tremendous light on some of the central documents and ideas, and even some of the civic rituals of the American Republic.
Next on Jewish Ideas and the American Founders, Washington, Satius, and Giving Thanks.